Thanks very much. I'm really happy to be here to be able to talk about some of our recent work in nano-indentation of geologic materials, and hopefully with some relevance for earthquake mechanics. And before I get started, I'd like to thank my co-workers, Andre Rahr and George Farr at Oak Ridge Lab, where the experiments were carried out their nano-indentation equipment, and of course Terry Tullis at Brown, my colleague. And as most people in this room are probably aware, one of the most basic observations from rock friction experiments is that the friction increases with the log of stationary hold time, with the log of time. And so, and that behavior is typically interrogated using a so-called slide hold slide experiment. This is just a schematic of that kind of test. And so this is a plot of friction coefficient versus time on the x-axis, and this is real data for a granite rock. And in the test, the test is begun by sliding the sample at a slow rate, typically 1 micron per second, at which a steady state value of the friction is obtained. And then at some time, the load point velocity V0 here is set to zero, and the friction decays over the length of the hold. And then at the end of the hold, the load point velocity is set back to 1 micron per second, and friction increases up over a peak value, and then decreases over some characteristic sliding displacement back to the nominally same value that it had before the hold.
So during that so-called hold, the total distance moved depends upon the spring.
Right.
That's typically much less than V sub C and the stiffnesses that we use.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. There's very small shear displacements, I think, during the hold portion of the experiment. You know, this D sub C distance is on the order of 10 microns or so for typical lab tests, and I think the relaxation is smaller than that.
So that low value mu is not static coefficient friction.
This value here?
Yes.
It's sort of it's quasi-static. I mean, the sample is actually sliding extremely slowly during this part of the test, but so it's not truly stationary, but it's very, very, you know, it's a very slow rate of sliding.
And that wiggling overshoot is some finite experience.
Yeah, this is just some ringing due to the elastic interaction with the experimental apparatus.
So could you classify a static coefficient friction from that picture?
I guess a static coefficient of friction would be some asymptotic value at extremely long times of friction.
Below the dynamic coefficient of friction. I mean, if you use zero, the dynamic coefficient of friction there?
Yeah, this is the sliding coefficient of friction at that slip velocity.
I think you'd say that if mu peak was more of the static coefficient of friction. I mean, the static coefficient is what's needed to initiate motion. And in principle, when you're not trying to move it, it can decay away to zero without any problems. So that asymptotic value there would not really be relevant. So.
Is that peak really the force you had to apply, or is that something which factors in instrumental resolution and the dynamics of the machine and everything else?
There are some dynamic effects with the apparatus that we'll see later that in some cases there's during this reload there's destruction of contact area, so that this peak value is not the true value that you would measure if there was no destruction of contact area during the reload. So there.
And the peak in these experiments, I'm quite sure at least, is rate dependent. If you load at a higher rate, the peak is.
Absolutely. Higher. Yeah, that's right.
Well, there's no defined static coefficient of friction.
I'm sorry?
There's no defined static coefficient of friction.
No, friction is a function of
Or you could say there are many defined
static. But if you let it sit there for a year, would you have a static coefficient of friction? Would it heal? I mean, if it really healed, would you then have a static coefficient of friction?
I'm not sure of the answer to that.
I think that's...
Well, I think that mu peak is a good candidate to define a static coefficient of friction, even if it slightly depends on rate, because at mu peak, the slider is on the loop.
I just like it to say that.
Slow.
I just like it to say that.
It's very close to what could be defined as a static coefficient of friction, I guess.
Okay, so if you take this, either the peak value in friction or the change in friction and plot versus the log of the hold time, then you get a linear relationship between friction and log time. And this has been shown for experiments on bare surfaces and also for experiments on simulated gouge layers, so that we have a powdered rock layer in between two forcing blocks of rock.
And so what you're plotting there has nothing to do with this low value?
No.
That's decreasing continuously.
That's right, yeah. This is either the peak value of friction, and like all these plots, this is the peak value of friction. I guess they're all the peak, but you could also plot the change, and it's a linear relationship.
So is that a function of the rate or not?
It's
saying it's a function of the rate at which you do things.
Right.
It's a uniform loss.
But then you can't determine the values of that if that's rate dependent.
If you control the rate,
for that rate. But for different applications of the new sliding loss, you would get different answers.
Yeah, but it's a uniform offset.
So the peak is always the same. What determines the value of the peak?
Time of contact and moving speed. Or the time of hold and moving speed.
Okay, so the loading, okay, all right. So it's not the rate at which you go the loading speed, it's the loading speed itself.
Yeah.
That time dependence is also manifest as a velocity dependence of friction due to the different time of contact at different sliding velocities. So this is a velocity stepping test, the other sort of standard rock friction test, in which we're sliding at some velocity V1, and then the velocity is stepped to a higher velocity, an E-fold increase in velocity here. And what one observes is a direct effect, always in the same sense as the velocity step. If this was a decrease in velocity, then the direct effect would be in the opposite sense. And then an evolution of friction away from that peak value over some characteristic distance taken to be the average size of the contacts on the sliding surface, and until you obtain a new steady state velocity at the higher, or a steady state friction rather, at the higher slip velocity. And this is just a figure that shows that that effect has been observed both for bare surfaces, this is initially bare surface of granite, and also for quartz, in this case quartz gouge. And Dietrich and Kilgore in their 94 paper showed that kind of behavior is observed for a wide range of materials, not just geologic materials, but wood and plastic and glass. So all of those, so the direct and evolution effects are sort of embodied in the rate and state friction laws, which say that friction is nominally constant, but there are small scale perturbations to the friction due to rate and state effects. And the state variable theta here has units of time and is thought of as the contact time. And there are a couple of evolution laws for the state variable, the slowness and slip laws, and the slowness law does a better job, I think, with the experimental data, and so is more commonly used. But it's these small-scale perturbations that determine the stability and whether earthquakes can nucleate, and so they're quite important to understand. So this is the Rayton state law again, and if the direct effect, this the magnitude of A here, is larger than the magnitude of the evolution effect, the given by B in the figure, then that so-called velocity strengthening behavior gives rise to always stable behavior, so you can't nucleate earthquakes. Whereas in the case where A minus B is negative, so-called velocity weakening behavior, shown in red here, leads to at least conditionally unstable behavior, and earthquake nucleation is at least possible. Oops.
Not that the block is moving, but at which you're loading the spring, correct?
I'm sorry, say again.
It's the stage velocity and the instantaneous velocity, which is the same as the average block velocity, but the instantaneous block velocity may be different.
Yeah, so that's I guess, my question.
So the compliance is... You can calculate the compliance which characterizes the stiffness of the apparatus. I forget the exact definition, but I remember it's often symbolized by mu. Do you remember what that is, or did you?
I don't.
Because comparing that to the frictional forces has a large effect on the dynamics.
Yeah. So sort of the Maybe the most important thing to understand is the evolution effect. In comparison, I think the direct effect is probably better understood as the rate dependence of shearing of asperities on the sliding surface. And so what gives rise to the time dependence of friction in its simplest manifestation as the increase in friction with the hold time, as in a slide-hold-slide test. And this was investigated in some really elegant experiments of Dietrich and Kilgore with a so-called see-through apparatus. And the apparatus, the sample is located right here, and the sliding surface is actually a little raised button there to increase the normal stress in the experiments. And then with a series of beam turners, transparent beam turners, they were able to direct light from a light source across the contact surface between the two rough surfaces. And using that apparatus, they were able to quantify the area of contact between the two rough surfaces, since light passes right through the surface for areas that are in contact, and those show up as sort of white areas on a black background. And where the surface is not in contact, there's light doesn't pass through and shows up as a black background. And these experiments were done on acrylic plastic and glass and also some experiments on quartz. And this is just one of their examples or one of their results from its experiments on acrylic plastic. And there are three different times here. So the red color is after a time of 1 second. After a time of 100 seconds, the contacts have grown in size, so you can see that there's yellow color outlining the red. And then after 10,000 seconds, many of those contacts have increased in size even further. In some cases, you have contacts that come in between 100 and 10,000 seconds that weren't present at the initial part of the experiment. But this is acrylic plastic, and I don't think the results are quite as convincing for quartz and other, you know, hard geologic materials. So I think that there's still some question about what the processes are at the asperities on the sliding surface. So the frictional force is just equal to the sort of the average contact stress, or if the contacts are flowing plastically, the sort of the shear yield stress times the sum of the area of each contact on the on the surface. And so you could sort of the standard explanation for the time dependence of friction is that the area is a function of time. That is, the contacts are very highly stressed. They creep, and the area increases with time, and hence the friction goes up. But you might also imagine that the quality of the contact changes during the hold, such that there's better bonding across the interface, increase in the adhesive strength of the contacts, and that might also give rise to an increase in friction. And so, but it's difficult to isolate the creep mechanisms and the processes that happen at these microscopic contacts for geologic materials. And so one possible way of getting at those deformation mechanisms is by indentation testing. And in an indentation test, we simply bring a diamond in contact with a sample. In this case, this is a sharp Berkovich indenter. And there's some hydrostatic region beneath the indenter that sort of acts like an extension of the indenter into the sample, but then a plastic zone between that hydrostatic zone and the elastic hinterland that's not really deforming. And sort of the most basic parameter in a indentation test is the hardness, and it's simply the load applied to the indenter divided by the nominal or the projected area of contact of the indenter tip. And again, this is a three-sided pyramid of a Berkovich indenter, and I'll show some other results with a Vickers indenter, which is a four-sided pyramid. And so, in order to determine the area of indentation contact and hence the indentation creep rate, and the old way is simply to bring the indenter in contact with a sample for some time, let it sit on the surface for some time, and then afterwards measure the size of the impression using, for example, a optical microscope or a scanning electron microscope. But sort of the more modern way of doing this is through instrumented indentation tests, in which we apply some load to an indenter, a servo-controlled load, and then measure the displacement of the indenter tip into the sample. And you know precisely what the area function of the tip is. The tip area is a function of the displacement, and so without imaging, you know what the area of the contact is from measurements of displacement of the indenter into the sample. So this is kind of a schematic picture of the nano indenter. So the sample sits here. There are a series of capacitance plates that measure the normal displacement, sub-nanometer resolution in the normal displacement, and important for our purposes, a lateral displacement gauge here that allows us to make friction measurements, and I'll talk about some of those tests later. And then it's an electromagnetic coil that applies a load to the specimen. But one really bad problem with the nano indenter, especially for doing indentation creep tests on very hard materials like quartz and olivine and other ceramic-like materials, is that the creep displacements here are so small that they get flooded by variation by apparent displacements that result from thermal expansion of the apparatus. So you can imagine here that there's some temperature change around the machine, and that expands the machine. If we're maintaining a constant load here, then the displacement, the tip has to displace to maintain a constant load. And so you measure some apparent displacement that doesn't have anything to do with the creep of the specimen, but is rather just due to thermal fluctuations. And so this figure sort of illustrates that effect. This is kind of a conventional nano indentation creep test. And this is the tip displacement into the sample here. And there are two different tests, and so there are two different traces for those tests. And the loading history for the two tests is identical. So the test is done by loading up to some constant load, in this case 50 millinewtons, and then after some, and letting the indenter creep into the sample, and then after some time unloading to about 10% of the load that was on the sample. And because the stress exponent for the deformation is so high, a big change in the applied load means a whopping big change in the strain rate, such that there's no creep going on at this part of the experiment, and the indenter is sort of acting like a thermal expansion gauge and measuring the thermal drift. So in the green case here, we see what looks like a nice creep curve during the creep portion of the test, but then during this thermal drift measuring portion of the test, you see that there's also a positive rate. So a lot of that signal is due to thermal effects. And then in the other case, we see that it looks like the indenter is actually backing out of the sample. But then if we look at the thermal drift record after the creep portion, there's a negative drift rate. So all of that negative creep rate is just a function of the thermal effects. Oops. So one way around this is the use of so-called continuous stiffness methods. And in the continuous stiffness technique, you basically apply some nominal load. In this case, this is during a ramp, and we would have a constant load here. And then you put a little sinusoidal wiggle in the indenter tip of some small magnitude compared to the nominal load. And with a lock-in amplifier, you can measure the amplitude of the displacement response to the wiggle and force, and also the phase shift. And so these equations come from a mechanical model of the indenter sample system, and there are a bunch of terms in here: the damping coefficient for the indenter and the sample, the frequency, the mass of the indenter, but what we're interested in is the contact stiffness, and this is this case of S value. So
this assumes that the response to the sinusoidal perturbation is linear, that there's no extra plasticity.
I think that's right, yeah. And so so with the lock-in amplifier, you can measure these parameters, and through careful calibration of the apparatus, you know what all these other parameters are, and you can calculate then the contact stiffness. And from the contact stiffness, then you know what the contact area is through this very classical relationship between stiffness and contact area. This is the reduced modulus that takes into account the elastic properties of indenter and sample. And people who use you can determine the modulus from these kinds of experiments, from a different kind of experiment where you just load up the sample and unload. So people typically flip this around. They know the contact area because there's no thermal drift over these short-term tests. So they know the contact area from displacement, and they know the contact stiffness. It's just the slope of the unloading curve up here at the very top of the curve. And so they then get the modulus from those types of measurements. Here we know the modulus from these kinds of tests, a different kind of test. We know the contact stiffness from this analysis, and so we can calculate the contact area. And so in these, the measurements are made over very short time scales, so the thermal drift is small, and so you can you can do very long-term creep experiments with very small creep displacements, and that's exactly what we need for tests, room temperature tests on geologic materials. So in the first part here, I'll talk about these indentation creep experiments. And they were all done at room temperature and sort of ambient humidity. They were done on polished single crystals of various rock-forming minerals down to about 30 nanometers grit polish.
What, in terms of abrasive grit numbers, that must be
10,000?
Yeah, right. And then the tests were done with both a diamond Berkovich indenter, a sharpened indenter, and as well as a ruby ball, but I won't show any of those experiments today. And over a pretty wide range of indentation loads, and we made use throughout of this continuous stiffness technique. And importantly, we did the experiments for up to 50,000 seconds. And if I didn't really point it out on the earlier plots, but these are kind of the longest times that have been done in slide-hold-slide rock friction experiments. And so we'd like to be able to compare between those two types of tests. This is just a quick picture of the two machines. And the only thing I want to point out here is that, you know, the indenters are housed in these sound insulated and thermally insulated boxes and on a heavy base to reduce the effect of mechanical and thermal noise in the environment. So we've done indentation creep tests on a whole range of geologic materials now. I'm only going to show results today for quartz, olivine, and calcite just because I don't have enough time to talk about the rest. And then we also did a lot of experiments on non-mineral samples, so fused quartz, aluminum, and diamond. And those were primarily used for calibration purposes. So this is a figure that shows, so it sort of illustrates the utility of the continuous stiffness technique. Here we're plotting contact stiffness on the left-hand side of the plot, time on the bottom, and then the displacement of the indenter into the sample, or at least the apparent displacement on the right-hand side. And so so as you load up the indenter, the indenter penetrates into the sample basically as fast as you push it in due to plasticity. But then at some point where the peak, the load that you the load that you want to apply to the sample is achieved, then the sample sits under that constant load and creeps at a really low rate. And there is a slope to this data, and it looks something like that. If you look at the displacement record for those two tests and the colors correspond, then you'd predict two very different creep rates in the two experiments, and that's just due to the thermal drift effects. So the contact stiffness measurements are quite useful for getting rid of this effect of thermal drift. So, and also as a test, we did experiments on diamonds. So this is a diamond Berkovich tip onto where we tried to indent a diamond sample. And what you observe is there's no increase in the contact stiffness with time in the two different tests, whereas if you had determined the contact area from the displacement measurements, you would have got a positive and a negative creep rate. So the fact that we don't get any creep in this test lended a lot of support to this not being a instrument artifact. And we also looked in the SEM, a high-resolution field emission SEM, at some of the residual imprints from the indentation. So there are two different loads here, 50 and 700 millinewtons. The ones on the left side were for 100 seconds of time, and the ones on the right were for 10,000 seconds. And it may not be clear from where you're sitting, but I've done quite a bit of image analysis on these things. And if we were looking at the original micrograph, I think I could convince you that this is about 10% larger than the indent on the right, on the left-hand side. So that seems to be pretty good ground truth. that the samples are in fact creeping. So in the case of quartz, it's not exactly clear what the deformation mechanism is. There's been some previous work done by Masuda et al., where they, and these are Vickers indents with comparable loads to the ones that we use in our experiments. And this is a TEM foil of the indented volume, and the Vickers is square, so it kind of fits in like that. And what they did not observe were any dislocations in the indented volume, and they, but when they looked at the diffraction patterns, both inside, or I'm sorry, outside of the indent as well as inside, there seemed to be some distortion of the diffraction pattern, which led them to surmise that there's some amorphization going on in the sample, and that there's some, and they termed this a lattice creasing mechanism. There have been some experiments done in the diamond anvil cell, and these are without a confining medium, so that there's a large component of shear stress to the experiments. And what they observe are the formation of these amorphous lamellae in a quartz sample. And these are some indents on glasses that show these kind of shear features, shear faults. Those are not brittle features, and they're plastic deformation features. And when we look at the indents in the SEM, we do see some sort of planar-looking features that are sort of parallel to the sides of the indentation. So all of this might be pointing to some sort of amorphization and maybe shear on those amorphous bands in the material. But that, to know for sure, that that's going to await some TEM work on some of our indented samples. And that you get amorphous material at the high stress disparity contacts in quartz rocks might explain the observation that when you look at wear debris, that's fault gouge on initially bare surfaces. This is some work done by Dick Yund at Brown some time ago. The material on the fault surface is essentially amorphous to electron diffraction. And it wasn't clear whether that's due to the thickness of the number of grains in a TEM foil or whether this is actually amorphous material, but at least it does seem to at least qualitatively fit in with the other observations. So these are some tests we did with the Berkovich diamond indenter on olivine. And again, this is a contact stiffness in time, and it shows. And now I've removed all the loading portions, so this is all for the part of the experiment where the full load is on the sample, and you can see some creep goes on during the experiment. And we played around with the time constant and the analysis of contact stiffness, and you can improve the quality of the data considerably. And so these are some indentations in olivine, and olivine has a really nice feature that you can oxidize the samples, and you basically then decorate the dislocation structures in the sample. And because iron oxide, which deposits along the dislocation cores, is opaque, then these show up as dark lines in a standard thin section of the material. So with an optical microscope, you can look at the large-scale dislocation structure in a sample. And so these are a series of four indents in the sample, and I'm going to blow this up a little bit so we can see a little bit better. So this is a blow up of one of the indents, and this is a Berkovich indent, so it's a triangular pattern that you can hopefully see there. There are radial cracks that emanate from the corners of the indent, but then there are these beautiful dislocation loops that are formed as a result of the indentation. And where they terminate the surface of the sample, they're little black dots. And if I had a microscope here and we could focus up and down, you could go from that black dot to and watch the in-focus part of the dislocation trace out the dislocation loop. So
is every one of those little dark dots where a dislocation loop emerges?
That's right, yeah. So there are hundreds of dislocations around the indent here. I think I have even a little bit higher magnification. So yeah, each of those dots is a dislocation loop. So there are probably several hundred dislocations.
And then the loops that we can see in between, or are inside the sample, or are those what is
broken? Well, the loops terminate on the surface in that dot, but then everything else you see, these lines are all within the surface of the sample. And that you oxidize the sample down to some level, and I don't know exactly what it is, but you know, the upper surface of the sample, you can see the dislocation structure. If you look at these, this is kind of the background dislocation density of the sample, and you know, you can see over some thickness of the sample, you can see the dislocation line, but then it kind of dies out at depth, so that's kind of the limit of the oxidation thickness during the decoration part of the experiment. But it's very useful, and compared to TEM measurements, you sort of see the large scale dislocation structure rather than a very limited.
Those cracks that you have there, do they form during the indentation or unloading?
I suspect that some of them happen on unloading, and that's what other people have observed for other brittle materials like glasses. And
if they happen during the loading, I was wondering if that would affect the stiffness measurement.
It might, yeah. But I don't know. The little bit of unloading you do during the stiffness measurements may not be enough to induce the cracking. So.
When we did glass, we had a little optical technique where we were looking through the indenter so we could watch it
right.
While it was being indented.
Right.
And oftentimes you pull the indenter off, and then there'd be maybe up to a second delay, and then ping.
Right.
Right.
But don't you think that due to the presence of these cracks, as the relationship between the stiffness and the contact area is something complicated?
It might be. There might be an effect of cracking on stiffness.
Is it formed during
the right.
After all, you
right.
You probe something which is much more complicated than
right. The I should say that this is one of the higher load indents that we did. And we did a lot of indents where we tried to keep the load small enough that you didn't get any cracks on the sides. And you still see the same creep behavior, and it's, it agrees well with the mechanical data you get for these kind of indents. So cracking may not have a big effect on the stiffness. We also did some tests on calcite, and this is all I'm going to show. It's just sort of similar behavior. A larger degree of creep for calcite, and you might expect that since it undergoes plastic deformation at lower pressures. We've seen some evidence of plastic deformation and twinning beneath the indents, but I don't have any pictures to show you of that. So you can make plots of strain rate, effective strain rate versus effective stress from the stiffness data, and the effective stress is just the hardness, and so the load divided by the area. And the effective strain rate is just the time rate of change of the stiffness divided by the stiffness, and you get very large stress exponents for this creep deformation, sort of. Quartz 50, olivine 44, and 80 for calcite, and so this is not power law creep. This is you know, very much in a power law breakdown sort of deformation environment, and these kind of values are what you also get from rock friction experiments. So again, I've shown you data for quartz, olivine, and calcite, and because of time, I won't be able to show you these data, but all of them undergo indentation creep at room temperature, including garnet, which is a very tough material. So now I'd like to compare the indentation data with slide hold slide rock friction data. And this idea kind of follows from one of Jim Dietrich's papers. And So we're going to compare with rock, slide-hold-slide rock friction data for both bare surfaces and simulated gouge. And sort of the implicit assumption here is that we can compare the fractional change in area from the indentation test with the fractional change in friction from the slide-hold-slide test, and sort of the implicit assumption is that any change in the friction in slide-hold-slide experiments results from changes in the contact area. So the friction experiments were done, all the ones I'll show were done at Brown University, and this is our rotary shear apparatus, and I won't go into this in too much detail, but it's basically a high-pressure cylinder up here in which the sample sits and is isolated from the gas confining medium. And it's got a right-hand gearbox here and a piston that goes up through some seals, and it rotates the sample. So it's a rotary shear geometry, and it's a big machine. Terry's head comes up about right here on the apparatus, so you need stairs to get to the top. And the sample assembly sits, again, inside the apparatus, and they're basically ring-shaped samples of rocks. They're isolated from the confining medium by O-rings and Teflon seals. And it's a rotary shear geometry in which we maintain a constant axial load on the sample and then rotate the bottom of the sample assembly. And the nice feature of this apparatus is that we can sort of get very large earthquake-like slip displacements, but that's a different problem. And there's an internal resolver that measures the displacement on the sliding surface, and we measure it as close to the sliding surface as we can get with an LVDT that measures the fault normal displacement during the experiment.
Once again, question about that?
Uh-huh.
So how stiff is this apparatus?
I don't remember the exact number. It depends in what mode you operate the apparatus. There's a rotary servo actuator here that servo controls the sliding displacement on this resolver signal. So in that mode, it's a very stiff machine in comparison to just controlling the load point velocity out here at the stepper motor and not controlling the velocity using that feedback signal on the resolver. So I don't remember the number, though, for the...
But when you are using feedback, then stiffness is frequency dependent. It depends upon the scale in which the feedback loop can actually respond.
Yeah. Okay, so now I'm comparing indentation data with data from these slide-hold-slide experiments. And so here I'm for the indentation data, this is the fractional change in area over the course of the experiment compared to the fractional change in friction that we observed in slide-hold-slide experiments. And in both cases, you know, you see this linear relationship between either of those parameters and the time of contact. But the area change that you measure in the indentation test is a lot higher than what you infer to occur in the slide-hold-slide experiments. And that comparison gets even worse for other materials. Again, in this case, you know, this is a factor of five or so for olivine, and this is both experiments on a dunite, which is an olivine rock, and also powdered samples of dunite. And for calcite, it's ridiculous. I mean, this is about a 40% change in the area during the indentation tests. And you would infer an area change of about, well, in some cases, much less than 0.1, or from 0.1 from the measurements of friction in the slide-hold-slide test. So what might give rise to that sort of effect? Well, one clue might be these experiments, the see-through experiments of Jim Dietrich's, where they saw a destruction of contact area during the reload up to the peak friction. And I'll explain what I mean there. So this is a slide-hold-slide test done with the see-through apparatus. And here is sliding at before the hold, and then there's some hold period. And then the load point velocity is then set back to the preload velocity, and friction moves up over a peak and then back down to a steady state. And what they observed was that the peak in friction was measured after there had been a significant decrease in the real area of contact, which they were able to measure using the illumination technique, so that so that contact area was destroyed during the load up to peak friction. And so they also did micro indentation experiments on the same materials, glass and acrylic, and so the micro indentation change in area matched that of the real area that they measured using the illumination technique, but the slide hold slide value of fractional change in friction was a lot less, and that's exactly the kind of thing that we saw in our in the comparisons of the last few figures. So that's one possibility, and the other possibility is that the contact stresses in a slide hold slide rock friction experiment, at least for some of the contacts, might not be as high as in a nano indentation test. So even on a rough surface, there might be contacts that sort of approximate an elastic contact and are not plastically deforming and may sort of hold up plastic deformation of the other contacts. There also may be emergence of new contacts that decrease the average contact stress, and that's, we saw some of those emerging new contacts in some of the experiments that Jim did on acrylic plastic. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about some preliminary nano indentation friction experiments. And we've basically done experiments with two configurations, and one is with a ruby, 500 micron radius ruby on various samples, and also scratch tests with a sharp Berkovich and Denner on a variety of samples. Again, these are all polished single crystals, a pretty wide range of loads, and also we again use this continuous stiffness method to monitor the contact area.
Can you go back? Which way do you? Okay, so you slide the indenter, the Berkovich indenter with the.
It's like a boat
going forward.
Right, like a boat through water. There was one test where we had the direction reversed and went the opposite way, and I'll show you a picture from those scratches. But we. Our intent was to have the indenter moving in that direction. So these are slide hold slide experiments in the nano indenter. So they're much like the rock friction experiments. And here I'm plotting the friction coefficient. That's the shear force on the indenter divided by the load. And there are three different holds here. 100 seconds, 1,000 seconds, and 10,000 second holds. And so what we observe is, and so the friction is in the upper part of the plot, and it's plotted here, of course, and the stiffness is plotted on the right-hand side. And although there's a lot of noise in the stiffness in these experiments, what you can see is that during the hold portions of the experiments, the stiffness is always higher than it is during the sliding part. So you lose some contact just due to sliding of the ball, probably on the trailing edge of the sphere. But what you can see is there's a nominal level of friction that looks something like that during sliding. But at the end of the holds on reload, there's an increase in the friction, and that increases with the log of the hold time.
Just a question, the absolute numbers for the friction coefficient here look fairly low.
They are very low, yeah, right. And I'll talk about that a little bit.
And do you think you had, with a spherical indenter, you don't necessarily have plastic deformation here underneath the indenter yet?
Right.
You think you had plastic deformation?
My guess is there's no plastic deformation in these experiments. We did some load-unload experiments with the ball, just a static load unload, and you know, those curves lay right on top of each other, so you don't see, at least you don't see any offset that would suggest that there's any plastic deformation going on.
Okay.
No.
And the other thing would be, if you do just contact mechanics, I thought as you increase the lateral stress, the contact area is supposed to grow, right? If you go from Hertz normal contact and you add a shear force, I thought the...
Shear force without sliding?
Just begins to slide, yeah.
I had read a paper by Sharp and Ashby and others a few days ago, and it was the opposite, that with the lateral, well, actually not opposite, but
if you add a shear component to a Hertzian contact, you with a crack which grows from the edge of the channel, you mark.
You're talking about the Niven calculation?
Yes.
But it depends on whether it slides or not. It depends whether the contact point manages to spread or not.
Depends on whether the friction is enough that it...
Well, there is a singularity at the edge, so...
Right, but it's a singularity, but there's then a stress intensity factor that tells you whether or not... That there are two possibilities. One is that the contact spreads and the singularity goes down enough that it is able to drive the crack in. And the other possibility is it drives in a perpendicular crack. Mm-hmm.
I'm just going to focus on one of these points here, so we can see a little bit more detail about what's happening. So this is the end of the 1,000-second hold, and here I set the load point velocity back to 1 micron per second. The sample loads up over a friction peak, and then decreases to some nominally steady value, and that slip displacement is about 10 microns or so. And if you calculate what the contact size ought to be from Hertzian contact theory, it's about 18 microns or so. But you also observe that there's a decrease in stiffness during the reload. So it suggests that there's some loss of area on reloading to the peak friction, much like Jim saw in the friction experiments on analog materials. And so that the difference in those contact areas might be taken up by that. And this is just a plot that shows that experiments at two different loads. At the higher load, the friction is higher and also the stiffness is higher, so the contact is increasing in size with increases in normal load, as you expect. Oops. So this is a figure that I put in just to remind me that there is no, and this is not a, you know, if you can't see anything, don't worry, because you're not supposed to. There's essentially an invisible scratch track in the case of the ruby ball on quartz. Oops. So you can't see the scratch track in that case. Okay, so I've described the ruby ball experiments on quartz, and now I'd like to talk about some Berkovich and Denner scratches on a couple of different materials. And in that case, you expect that there's some plastic deformation of the Denner tip in contact with the sample during the hold portions of the experiments. And just to show you a really nice example of that, this is an experiment on aluminum, so this is a soft material that creeps readily. And again, it's a slide-hold-slide experiment. And so during the sliding portion of the experiment, and that's these flat regions down here, the stiffness is quite constant and is lower than it is during the hold portions of the experiment. But then during the holds, there's significant creep of the indenter into the sample. And you can see it quite nicely for all three different holds. And I won't show any other plots, but the friction that you measure after the holds is also increases during the holds in proportion to the log of the contact time. So that's a great example of creep during the experiments. And for hard materials like quartz, it's not always so clear. So this is a Diamond-Berkovich test on quartz. And so again, the standard slide hold slide friction experiment. And what you can see, at least for the first two holds, there is some positive slope to the stiffness data during the hold portions of the experiment and the initial part of that one, but then something happens at the end, and I'm not, that may be some machine problem. So there is some increase in the friction or increase in the area due to creep during the holds in these slide hold slide tests. But there's not much of an increase, if any, in the friction after the holds.
And then you're getting a really strong evolution, at least an evolution of the strength with displacement over time there.
Overall. Here?
Yeah, that rising curve.
Right.
Any idea what's going on there? We see rock friction experiments all the time.
It's
for unknown reasons that
right.
I thought you would see in a simpler system.
It's possible that you're abrading the diamond in the early part of the experiment, so you increase the contact area underneath somehow. I guess
building up some stuff you're plowing ahead.
Yeah, there could be some wear debris ahead of the indenter that you're kind of having to plow through more and more as you go on.
Do you image the tips before and after at all?
We don't image the tips, but there's a kind of a standard indentation routine that you can use on fused quartz. And so you can calculate just from indents and unloading without imaging what the tip shape is. In the case of the, for all of these experiments, after each one of these slide hold slide tests, we ran that calibration test. There didn't seem to be big changes in the shape of the indenter tip from test to test. So just focusing in on, I think it's this hold here, show some of the data. And so the data is quite a bit noisier than in some of the other experiments. And whether this is an increase in the friction or not compared to the background is a little bit difficult to say. What you can also observe is that at the peak in friction, if this is a peak in friction after the hold, there's no destruction of contact area before the peak in friction is measured. And so if that's the peak in friction and this is kind of the background level here, then this change in friction is just about exactly what you would predict from this change in the stiffness. And as you lose contact area between the static and the sliding cases. So these are the Diamond-Berkovich scratches on quartz. So these are with the boat moving in the right direction. And the scratch track is actually in the middle of these little kind of football-shaped cracks. And then these cracks form on the outside of the outside of the scratches, and by accident we moved the indenter in the wrong direction and saw a quite different fracture pattern that resulted from those from that scratch.
You see here there's a certain frequency of, is it reflected this by this oscillation that you have in the curve?
These probably don't correlate with any oscillations that we saw on the friction curve, but some of these shorter wavelength fracture events probably do correspond with the spiky friction that we saw in the experiment. It'd be interesting to see if you could make some correlation with that case.
What was the coefficient of friction you got for these?
Oh, that's a good point. It's actually quite a bit higher than it is in the Ruby ball case. So it's at least a factor of two in most cases higher. Right. And some of the Ruby...
Over key.
Right. Yeah. And we've done some Ruby ball tests that have friction coefficients of like 0.05, so it can be really quite low.
What is the sliding velocity?
All the sliding velocities for any of the experiments that I'll show are 1 micron per second.
So
So we haven't yet done velocity stepping experiments, but that's an easy thing to do. This is the test showing Diamond Berkovich sliding on olivine. And again, you can see some positive creep in each of the hold segments during the test. And there's really no healing at the end of the experiment, but it's probably, again, due to this destruction of contact area that happens during the reload. So you can imagine that if the peak in friction should be somewhere in here, by the time you measure that, you know, the contact area has changed from the value that you obtained during the hold to pretty close to what it is after the hold. So looks like much of the contact area is destroyed on reloading. And again, we use this olivine decoration technique to look at the dislocation structures in the samples. So these little looks like dirt on the sample are actually dislocations. So that's kind of the background dislocation density for olivine. And then there are four scratches at different loads on the specimen, and I'll kind of blow these up again. So in this case, you can see this is the scratch, obviously, and there are numerous fractures within the scratch, and also on the periphery. There are little conchoidal fractures that happen, kind of spall off as the indenter moves through the sample. But just like in the static indentation case, you can see these dislocation loops that form on the edge of the scratches. And I really wish this came out clearer, because they're all along this scratch track and quite beautiful. And there's some in there as well. I haven't tried to do that, but I bet that you could.
Or more surface area.
Right.
Resistance.
Right.
And you did the same experiment with the spherical indenter?
No, I guess there's nothing. You didn't see any scratch?
You didn't see any scratch. No, I didn't. I'd like to do that. That would be really interesting. Yeah. I think I have just a little bit of a blow up here, but again, you can... The loops terminate in little dots where they intersect the surface, and it looks like they terminate on the crack, but these dislocations become more heavily oxidized because the crack is there, and so it's probably just that effect and not dislocations that terminate on the crack. And you can't really see much more. So just to summarize some of the observations for quartz, because we have tests of both kinds. In the case of the ruby sphere on quartz, we observe very low friction, on the order of 0.1 or so. From Hertz theory, from these load-unload tests, you'd say that the contact is fully elastic. We can't see any kind of scratch track after the experiment. And if you calculate the area of contact, it's quite large compared to the other case. So it's, 250 square microns or so, depending on the load on the sample. So the shear stress is on the order of a kilobar or so. Whereas in the Diamond Berkovich case, the friction is quite a bit higher than it is for the ruby sphere. So it's still low compared to rocks, but quite a bit higher. We see evidence for plastic deformation from load-unload tests and from the stiffness measurements. We see a prominent scratch track in those experiments, but the contact area is much, much smaller than it is for the ruby ball case. So it's, five square microns or so. But the stress is a lot, lot higher in this case. The shear stress is on the order of 4 gigapascals or so. And so it seems like there are different processes going on. And in this case, the shear stress may be limited by the adhesive strength of the ruby ball on the sample, whereas in the case of the diamond, there's probably a large component of plowing, as the indenter has to plastically deform and plow through the sample, and also fracture of material in front of the indenter.
I'm just going to point out that the micro indentation tests on diamond give a normal contact stress of around 12 gigapascals.
Right, and that's what we get.
And so that's very consistent with the coefficient of friction of around a quarter or a third.
Right.
And when we did the quartz on quartz sliding, we got comparable contact areas around 120, I'm sorry, about 12 gigapascals, but coefficients of friction of 0.6 or 0.7. So we were having shear strength of the contact somehow was about twice that. I'm just mentioning because it's curious.
Right, yeah, right.
It's a little bit scary.
Yeah, it's just way down.
Way below.
Way down, way down.
You mentioned adhesion. I'm just wondering what your picture of that is. It looks as if the conditions for the Roby sphere on the quartz are approaching those where you would say you've got incommensurate surfaces in contact with each other, and it's not clear why they should be sticking at all.
Right. I mean, it's possible that, you know, what I mean by adhesion here may be sort of the effect of a fluid film, for example, on the surface of the sample that you may, with time, kind of squeeze out of the contact. That's one possibility. I mean, it's not necessarily adhesion in the, you know, dry. It's not necessarily sort of dry adhesion in a high vacuum kind of situation.
So what is the ambient environment here?
It's just like this room.
There's no humidity control.
No. Well, the room has it is humidity controlled. It's, you know, low humidity, but not low humidity, not very low humidity.
And is there any chemical cooling of the surfaces before?
Just kind of wiping the surface with some solvent or something like that. So there may be stuff, there may be hydrocarbons on the surface that affect these kind of measurements.
So the adhesion could all be due to that, and water is some mixture.
Right.
Where this bridging.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, you could have bonds that are forming between the sphere and the sample, and you know, that may be the ability to do that may be affected by having water in between.
But Mark, if it were sphere and sample, wouldn't one be in this incommensurate territory where it would be hard to have for any friction at all? Yeah, that's a pretty large contact area. So.
Right. I mean, I think you need. Generically, you need something that's behaving in a plastic manner, and maybe it's a film at the surface that's doing that, as opposed to the Roby sphere and the quartz. And if this film was stuck, then you wouldn't see it. So.
Right.
And does the friction coefficient depend on the Roby? In the case of Roby or quartz?
I don't think so. Yeah.
Within this range.
Right. Oh, wait. Yeah, the friction depends on the load.
Coefficient.
Let me go back.
Talking of a friction coefficient, we assume some amount of load.
That's pretty constant.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's the difference between that and that.
So normally it goes the other way. Normally, if there's an adhesive, an extra adhesive load, then normally the friction coefficient goes down with increasing pressure rather than up.
Yeah, that's what it looks like it is today. There's the 0 point.
No, but when it goes to 100, a lower pressure.
At higher pressure, it looks like a lower coefficient friction.
No, shear force over normal force.
Oh, it's still normalized.
Yeah.
It increases from zero.
Yeah.
This idea of
fact that the coefficient of friction is increasing while the area is decreasing? Do you have an idea of what's going on there?
Oh, for the two different cases?
Well, just in both what Jim showed in Jim's data and your own, where you showed the peaks, the peak friction, the peak for the shear stress, it corresponds to actually a decrease in surface area.
You call it the destruction of contact area during loading.
Right.
Why? Where is it coming from? Do you have any idea?
I'm sorry. Can you say it again, please?
Oh, okay. I'm just trying to repeat your idea, probably badly. Right. But you showed that the peak stress in your Holt slide experiments corresponded. You got the highest stress, and actually you'd seen contact area being reduced.
Right.
That's what I understood at least.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, what I meant was that if there was no destruction in contact area here, that this peak would be even higher than.
Okay. Where's the destruction in contact area coming from for motion? This is actually, there's no motion right here. Right?
Well, there's only some, and that's why I wanted to ask about the compliance, because this, whenever the stress goes up, that means things have to move a little bit. So the question is, if it's weak enough, can there be some small displacement? Is that something that you can actually?
I think so. I think it's a real effect. It's.
But it could be from two. I mean, I'm sure it's a real effect. The question is, can it be? It's from the. You think it's actually moved by some amount comparable to DC before the force is loaded up to some
fraction of it. Yeah. Fraction. I have maybe another explanation based on some stuff we've seen that. I don't know. You get these. If you think of it as an earthquake, you get four shocks along the system before any motion occurs. You get a crack that goes along the contact interface and it rests. So nothing's actually moved. You kind of reset the contacts. So you don't have any, they're effectively weaker. Also redistributed the load. I don't know whether this would be interesting to maybe look at that.
And that makes it stronger or weaker? Your contacts are now younger.
It would both make it weaker on the one hand because you have fewer. The contact area is less, but the load has been redistributed among whatever asperities are holding the thing back. So it's essentially stronger on average. It's kind of a funny deal. Locally, wherever you've had something occur, you weaken those contacts. Basically, the ball or whatever is still pinned. So you squash the remaining contacts. They're holding more load, then these things start to recover. And you have these transients. See this transient change in contact area.
So. There's an asperity within asperity picture here. So the sphere is meant to mimic a single asperity, but the explanations are not talking about the asperities on the asperities.
Right.
Well, but it could be happening just at the edge, due to some.
Sure, a mid-level light spread. Yeah. But
in our case, it was a little easier to explain because we had a whole range of contact sizes in the. I think in our mind at least, as we're loading, the smallest contacts, it doesn't take much slip at all to wipe them out. And
so another question that I had is if you look at the onset of plasticity, it's dependent upon the angle of the the tip, and it's sort of hard to calculate for a sphere, which is why everyone uses these angled indenters. So do you think that just the tip-shaped geometry could lead to different aging effects, sort of from the first part of the talk, that you were comparing apples and oranges because you had a sharp angle versus a rough surface maybe being rounder? And if so, did you do Ruby sphere for the first part of your talk, or the?
I've done lots of Ruby sphere.
Do you get more or less the same discrepancy between the indenter and the?
It's
friction measurements or not?
If you plot fractional change in friction for the Ruby sphere versus delta or fractional change in friction from slide hold slide, it's even worse than.
Oh really?
Right. Because it's even worse. I mean, it's it plots probably at least factor of two higher than the Berkovich data. They're small changes in friction, but the base friction is so low that the fractional change is large.
Oh.
So it may not be the best way to compare those, I think. But.
So if you So
the friction coefficient for all the experiments we did was quite low compared to kind of standard rock friction experiments. I've done some experiments with rough rock samples. So these are rock friction experiments, rough samples on a polished substrate. And this is not, these have lots of irregularities on the surface, on the flat surface. But in those experiments, you get pretty low friction too. This is a kind of a complicated plot of friction coefficient and slip and velocity versus time. And this is a series of slide hold slides tests. But so these are the holds, these parts here. But, this blue line is the slip that we measure internally with that internal displacement device, so that the sample just begins to slide right here, and the friction is 0.25 or so. So at least in the early part of those experiments, the friction is quite low. And so maybe it points to the importance of interlocking of asperities and increased plowing in the rock friction case, and maybe as you continue to comminute the sample along this sort of track, that you increase the real area of contact, and that causes much higher friction in the rock friction, the typical rock friction case. So my conclusions are that all geologic materials undergo indentation creep, with the exception of diamond. I think we saw some evidence for kind of a solid state morphization of quartz, but it's by no means definite, I would say. And some evidence for dislocation motion beneath the indenter in both the sliding or in the beneath the indenter in the olivine case. In all cases, the area of the indentation increases linearly with log time up to about 50,000 seconds or so, kind of comparable to rock friction tests. And the change in fractional area with time in the nano indentation test is larger than that the fractional change in area that you infer to occur in a rock friction test. And that may be due to this loss of contact during reloading or maybe smaller contact stresses in rock friction tests. For the friction experiments, the friction in the Ruby ball test may be controlled by some measure of the adhesive strength of the contact junction, but the adhesion increases with the time of contact, but maybe maybe like we were saying, that there may be effects of impurities on the surface that are affecting that interpretation. The friction in the diamond Berkovich test is higher than in the ruby ball test, and that may point to the importance of plowing of the indenter in the specimen and interlocking, sort of plowing interlocking of the indenter with the surface. And the friction is low in both the Berkovich and Ball experiments compared to typical rock friction, and that may be due to a larger contribution of plowing and interlocking in rock friction tests, and a larger area of contact in the rock friction experiments. So, thank you very much for your time.
Solid-state amorphization quartz. Do you know what is the critical load where that happens? I'm just curious to know whether under indentation you see similar critical loading as what happens under hydrostatic pressure.
Right.
It's in like 20 GPA.
Yeah, I don't know for sure. I mean, for the sharp indenter, for all loads, the sort of the stress underneath the indenter is kind of nominally the same. So it's difficult to say for that case. Maybe if you had spherical indenters of small enough radius and high enough load, you could kind of figure that out. What pressure you needed to induce at least creep of the indenter into the sample, and if it's due to this amorphization.
So it was a sharp transition that you actually saw?
No, I...
It's just inferred,
right, yeah. Yeah, it's really based on no mechanical data that we have.
One of the things that Ben Schwan has found in some recent stuff is when we take rough surfaces of amorphous material where there's definitely plasticity going on within the contact, that we've seen the friction coefficient sort of scaling linearly with the roughness of the surface. So we're sort of in a different regime. And it's when you look at the sort of too rough surfaces, you get this 0.6, and you know, one of them's rough and low and smooth, and you get the... So I think in your next conclusion you talked about interlocking of asperities, and it does seem for really rough surfaces you may be able to get this new dissipation mechanism coming in, which has a strong dependence on the surface slope,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to the overall roughness. And it'd be interesting if you could, I don't know if you've looked at the spectrum of the roughness.
No. We have plans to do that.
This is kind of a general question. The experiments with the ruby ball where you're getting very low coefficients of friction and time dependence, those sound like those are closer to the surface force apparatus experiments than anything we've seen before.
Right.
Your comments suggest the presence of some film, some organic film or pollutants.
But the absolute numbers, you know, I think if you look for the surface force apparatus, they're often 0.05, 0.06. It's closer to the...
It depends on the pressure.
The pressures are lower than this.
There is a lot from the pressure of the FFA to the pressure of multi-contact experiments, and
right.
In between ball and flat is some intermediate situation.
But if you look at this, this shear stress being a tau naught plus alpha p, the alpha term, which should dominate these pressures, where there's less adhesion, that alpha is the one that I'm saying is 0.05.
I can show you results.
For the SFA?
No, it's lower than the flux.
But for the SFA, it's typically fairly limited around 0.05, which would not be so far off from it. The goofy sphere on 5. There it's harder to know what the shear strength is because the area is usually. Or you've measured it optically too?
Yes.
Or?
In your case, the real area of contact can be measured.
Right.
So it's transparent.
Right. Yeah. And you can also calculate it pretty well from the stiffness.
So really the question is not fixing this. So how do you interpret Biot's law in the context of these experiments?
Which you can. Speaking for myself, it's becoming an increasing mystery as to why we have these large contact shear strengths, so apparent shear strengths of contacts. When you kind of go to single contacts, more idealized things, it always comes out lower.
So you had Biot's law?
Yeah, friction of 0.6.
Yeah.
It's a restatement Jager's two laws of friction. First one was coefficient of friction of rocks is 0.6. Second law of friction was that experiments will make a monkey of you.
Is there a controlled gouge experiment? That is, there are, a lot of the thin experiments are mimicking single asperities. But what about clean experiments that mimic the presence of gouge between surfaces? Because that may be behind all of the, that may be behind 0.6 in the monkey.
So the question is, what's a clean gouge experiment?
Exactly. What's a clean, and how do you get clean dirt?
How do you get, and do you want spherical gouge or faceted gouge?
I don't know.
But attempts at this are really difficult. You know, my first naive attempt, and this was many, many years ago, was to grind up the material and carefully sit it so I knew exactly the size was. And of course, what we discovered eventually was that as soon as you put it under load, it goes to from a sorted distribution to a power law distribution.
Yeah.
This takes very little deformation to break all those little grains under the kind of stresses we have.
So you just need to make the static friction measurement, pull it apart, put the
gouge. Well, I mean.
And it's true when you put a gouge in that, well, you put it under confining pressure,
yeah,
and then you start to load it up. Those curves start rolling over very early, and sometimes they go through a peak and level out, sometimes they just kind of go out methodically. But if you're looking at the deflection from the loading curve, it looks like some amount of displacements are kind of really early on, maybe a third of the way up to the peak. Whether or not that's a friction, or
just a
lot.
The gouge is not packed. Right.
Just a little rearrangement of the gouge.
But inevitably it's going up, or you're not sure it's an actual real measurement of the coefficient of friction. I mean, it never goes down. You don't set up and it goes down at some time.
Yeah, sometimes you do. And you see that in soil experiments also. They call it over consolidated material. So you go over a peak and then you drop down.
This is because the density,
it's over intensifying. Once you start shearing it, then it's not impacted as well.
I mean, what we've seen here is that's correct me when I'm wrong, this is a word. The geometry of the indenture is critical in the following sense, that you can have the same contact area ostensibly for the ruby or for the diamond, but you're going to get very different frictional properties, basically because of that cusp in there, I suppose, or something.
Right.
Which, at least it's suggested that the pictures that you showed for olivine, that this fracturing mechanism has seriously contributed seriously contributing to the drag on the
right.
I'm not wrong here?
No, I think that's right. I mean, with the sharpened dunner, you always have some plastic deformation, and so then to translate, you have to plow through the material. In that case, so the friction's always higher.
But even statically, I would assume that cusp, that point would create a lot more dislocation. You have a stress singularity right there.
Right, right.
And you see that. I don't remember if you looked at comparable percentages of relative area of contact or something for the two, but...
Yeah, in one case I did, but for the ruby ball it was much, much higher than for the...
Okay, so these two numbers are for... They're both in the ostensibly elastic limit.
In this case, yeah.
Yeah, but then right. Did you look at the Berkowitz diamond or something... under the same ostensible stresses, normal stresses? Yeah, I mean, thinking about just the relative surface area. You know in the elastic contact what the surface area of this ruby sphere was deformed at a given load. You measure the amount of contact area that your diamond indenture has achieved, okay. You compare then the two experiments under ostensibly the same conditions, what do you see? I mean, basically the difference is plowing.
Yeah, I mean you...
One is reversible, one isn't. I mean, the top one has to be almost reversible, so you don't see anything. And the second one, the scratchy one, is totally reversible, so there's a lot of work to be done.
But it just comes down to the geometry of the inventor. Basically,
the load radius is roughly parallel.
Yeah. Right. Due to the geometry, then.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I wonder if you reverse to your, if you after plowing forwards, then you plow backwards over the same furrow, would you then have something that looked more like the ruby sphere?
You might.
That's the sort of thing that when people do pin on discs and they go back over and over and over again. They generally find the first pass the friction's higher and eventually it settles down to some final number, and they never tell you the first pass because that's not reproducible.
It's always when you throw away.
Right? Even the second one.
Yes. After 1,000.
Okay. Thank you.